Good evening, and welcome to tonight's live telephone town hall with Congressman Sam Farr. This technology allows the congressman to chat with hundreds of his Central Coast neighbors while sitting in his office here in Washington. In a few moments, we'll be joined by the congressman, but as more listeners come on the line, I'd like to explain what will happen in the next hour. At any time during the call, if you have a question you would like to ask Congressman Farr, please press star 3 on your phone. You will continue to hear the conference call until one of our town hall assistants can join you and take your question. Please be ready to give them your name, your city, and your question. This will allow us to keep the discussion flowing and to reduce redundant questions. If we can't get to your question during the call, you'll also be able to leave a message for the congressman at the end of the call, similar to a voicemail. It's a little extra incentive for you to join us for the full hour. Finally, a recording of this teleconference will be available on our website, so please visit www.far.house.gov and listen. Remember, if you'd like to ask Congressman Farr a question, now is a good time to press star 3 and a town hall assistant will be with you shortly. Now, I'd like to turn it over to Congressman Sam Farr. He served the Central Coast for more than 30 years as a county supervisor, state representative, and now in Congress. Congressman Farr?
Well, thank you very much. I want to wish everybody a good evening out in the West Coast. I want to thank you for taking time to participate in our telephone town hall meeting. And I'm glad you're being able to join us because it's a muggy night here in Washington, and I can't wait to get home to the cool coastal breeze of the Central Coast. I truly believe that the healthy democracy hinges on an open dialogue and a two-way communication between our government and its citizens. Discussions that take place 3,000 miles away here in Washington often seem very removed from your daily lives back there in California. That distance seems great, but by keeping an open line of communication, we can close that distance, which is why I do events like tonight's town hall meeting. It gives me an opportunity to hear from you, the constituents that I have the great opportunity and fortune to represent. But it's not only the way you can stay in touch with me. Tomorrow I'm flying home, and I will leave this heat and come home to the beautiful Central Coast for August recess. During that time, I'm hosting several town hall meetings throughout the district. This is an opportunity for us to meet personally so that we can discuss the issues that are important to you. Let me just give you a quick list of where those town hall meetings are. On Monday, August 13th, it will be in San Benito County. On August 22nd, which is a Wednesday night, it will be in Monterey. And on August 27th, which is also a Monday night, which is it will be in Salinas. And then it will be in Santa Cruz on Wednesday, August 29th. So four town hall meetings, San Benito County, Santa Cruz County, and two in Monterey County. For more details, you can, including the times and locations, you can visit my website, which is www.far.house.gov. There you can send me an email, learn more about my positions on issues, and sign up to receive updates from my office, including my e-newsletter. You also notice on the website links to all my social media, including Facebook and Twitter. These are great tools for us to communicate as they allow you to get real-time updates on me, including pictures and videos of opportunities here in Washington. And I'd like to suggest that you, if you like my Facebook page, you can go there to facebook.com/RepSamFarr and allow me or follow me, I mean, on Twitter, which is at RepSamFarr. Well, I love all these new forms of communicating. Nothing beats the old-fashioned conversation, and that's what we're here for tonight. So let's not waste any more time and listen to your questions and your concerns. Let's begin with the first question.
All right. While we're waiting for listeners to come on the line, I'm going to go ahead and ask a question of my own. Remember, callers, if you have a question for Congressman Farr, press star 3. You'll still be able to hear everything that's going on, and someone will be with you in a minute to take your question. Our first question is that today the GOP-controlled House rejected all of the Democratic tax proposals instead of voting for the Republican proposal. Can you explain the difference between the two plans?
Well, basically, yeah, we had a long debate today, and basically came down to two things. The Democrats want to give a tax break to the middle class while they're asking the upper 2% to pay their fair share. It would be an increase for closing the tax loopholes. Republicans, however, passed a bill that would only give tax cuts to the wealthy, following their lead last year of just sort of continuing that, which is now not enough money for us to keep a lot of programs, including our military, at full strength. So I think where you see the impasse we're at, we're in an impasse where the Republicans are unwilling to pass a common sense half-and-half plan, and now holding hostage about 98% of Americans who would receive a tax cut under our plan. So if you extend the middle class tax cuts, it means you get fairness for the middle class. It means you can have opportunities for job creation in our economy. You can have certainty for families, businesses, and how they both budget. The other plan is one that just makes the middle class pay more, forces us to borrow more from China, and increases the deficit. So we're heading home with nothing to show for the work, but a message that we want to keep the tax benefits for the rich, essentially a subsidy for the rich during this hard economic times. The Senate probably won't pass this bill, so we're still at an impasse of how we're going to resolve these differences by the end of the year. Let's hear from our listeners.
Thank you. Callers, remember, if you have a question for the congressman, press *3 at any point during the call, and someone will be with you shortly. Our next question comes from Miguel from Salinas. Miguel has a question about immigration reform. And Miguel, you are on with Congressman Farr.
Hello?
Yes.
Miguel?
Yes. Yes, this is Miguel. Yes, I got a question. I got almost 4 years hearing the immigration reform, and it's nothing clear.
You're concerned about what's really going on with immigration reform?
Yes.
Well, thank you for asking that question. We need immigration reform because our policies are stuck. We probably have maybe 11 million people in the United States that don't have papers. Some of them were young children that came here with their parents, too young to know the difference, too young to even know that and this is what President Obama has just allowed in what they call the DREAM Act, to allow them to apply for essentially a legal status and be qualified for loans for schools as long as their grades are good and things like that. But for the rest of the people, there's no change in anything. We have to have an act of Congress to do that. And I think what you find is it's the politics of it are pretty simple. Almost every business entity you know, and I don't know one that's opposed to it, wants immigration reform because their employees, they want them to, you know, they want them to stay with them. And the uncertainty of not having legal status means that you could be sent home at any time. So employers up and down the all over the country, in fact, in California, you get conservative groups like the business councils and chambers of commerce and farm bureaus and Western growers and things like that are all supportive, strongly supportive. So I hope that we can get over these sort of campaign dialogue and start dealing with substance rather than just trying to bash immigrants as a way of getting reelected by not doing anything whatsoever. And I think it's a poor way to go, and I'm long overdue for helping a comprehensive immigration reform. It combines three things. Really making sure our border is sealed and solid, and we can do that. Also, making sure that the people who've been here, who've never committed a crime or, you know, paying their taxes, trying to work hard, can find some legal status. And that would do by filing, if you've been on a job, getting verification from your employer that you've actually worked, doing a background check, and then you could apply for a green card, and you would have to show that you're learning English and would be paying taxes and so on. So that's the second part. And the third part is to take care of these kids that I just mentioned that who are graduating top of their class, they're very high in their classes, they're getting accepted to colleges, including in great schools like Stanford and Harvard. But because they don't have any green card, they cannot receive any public assistance or any scholarship. And we ought to not be denying the smartest and brightest people opportunity to a higher education just because their parents happened to bring them over the border before they had before the parents had legal status. So you're penalizing the kids now that they're 18, 19 years old, and we need to change that.
Thank you for that question. Our next question comes from Adolfo from Salinas. Adolfo has a question about postal reform.
Hello?
Hi, Adolfo?
Yes, this is Adolfo. I'm from Salinas. I would like to know how you stand on H.R. 2309, the postal reform bill that 2011.
Isn't that the bill that would eliminate the six-day delivery?
Pardon me?
I think that's the bill that would eliminate the six-day delivery, would eliminate the weekend delivery, and it would also close about 3,800 post offices. Is that the
right
bill you're talking about?
Yes.
I'm opposed to that bill. You know, the answer to this problem is to let the U.S. Postal Service pay retirement and health benefits gradually. You can't just sort of go from a government assistance and then just turn it into essentially a private nonprofit and say that you have to bear all the costs for all the retirement that they haven't had to do before. And I don't think that the way this bill handles it doesn't get anywhere. It just cuts, squeezes, and trims, and you, the consumer of mail, don't get the services. So I'm opposed to this bill. It's not the solution to the problem.
Thank you for that question. Our next question comes from John DeCour from Toro Park. John has a question about Clear Creek. John, you are on with Congressman Farr.
Hi. Yeah, they closed Clear Creek Recreation Area a few years back on a temporary closure.
Very familiar with it.
Okay. It's been beyond 2 years now, I guess. And the BLM, you know, is kind of running roughshod over everything. It was a sort of considered an OHV area, but it was also open to rock hounds and hikers, hunters. And there's...
I may have a great answer to your question. What would the question be?
Well, why can't they reopen that? Is there anything being done to rescind that EIR and take another look at it because of the nature of the actual chemical there? That it's a chrysalis asbestos and not a powder form.
Yeah, let me explain what the problem is to the rest of the listeners. In San Benito County, we had a lot of active asbestos mining. It's a surface material that was the surface mining. Did it for years and years. The government was one of the biggest purchasers of the material. That land is owned by the Bureau of Land Management, and we've used it for outdoor recreation. And one of the exciting parts of that land has been ideal for off-road vehicle, motorcycle riding and off-road vehicles. It's also been hiking, and there's some native plants and all kinds of interesting areas in there. The government is always, you know, in deep pockets being sued if anybody gets hurt. So what they found out, and the EPA found out from studies out there, that they thought this asbestos was friable and therefore could infect lungs and could give you asbestosis. And so instead of trying to figure out a way to allow people to not ride on the areas where the asbestos is or whatever, they just closed the whole area. And I'm very much opposed to having all that public land just sort of fenced off. And said there's got to be a workable solution. There's not a lot of incentive when people, when they hear from the legal committee saying, oh, my God, you know, I don't know how we can do this without being sued all the time. And I said, but there is a way. We do this. We take risks. We find out a good management. So, John, you'd be very excited as today I put in a bill in Congress to require looking at that whole issue again of trying to figure out what lands inside that I think it's about 60,000 acres could be set aside for wilderness area, so that in that part there would be no vehicles allowed. It would protect the native species and all those things. It would set aside other parts for passive recreation, and it would set aside parts for recreation like off-road vehicles. And I think, I mean, this bill has been well thought out. We've worked with the OHV community. We've worked with the environmental community. I think this is a partnership of everybody that ought to make sense. And we've just got to get Bureau of Land Management, we've got to get this bill passed. And it will require the Bureau of Land Management to come up with a plan and allow you access back into it. And I'm excited about that.
Thank you for that question. Our next question comes from Leonard McCullough from Salinas. Leonard has a question about the bank bailout. Leonard, you are on with Congressman Farr.
Congressman, how are you doing? I met you at Food Oil here a few months ago. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for listening.
Well, Congressman, my question is that these properties we have over here that we are upside down with the home loans, and the property is not worth what the loans were because, you know, you're very familiar
mm-hmm.
with the situation. My question is why, when the banks got the bailout, Congress didn't force them to reduce the principal to what these homes were worth so that people could really just start restructuring and keep their home at the market value that they are now instead of the banks still trying to hold the owners to the 600 or 500 or whatever it was originally.
Well, I'm very sympathetic to your issues and the concerns. We've tried to do and actually there is a bill out there, and if you know people that are facing this, we get calls every day, and I'll actually give you somebody in my office to talk to if you know people that need some specific help. But let me basically point out the problem is that people took out loans on their houses, and the value of their home was way up. The economy was booming. Everybody thought real estate would ever come down. Everybody bet on this. What caused the biggest problem is that the banks and secondary lenders and so on and speculators were just using this real estate, thinking this is a gold boom, and using all kinds of derivative swaps and things like that. They're inventing instruments that had never been used before in the marketplace. It was kind of a big betting game, and it all came crashing down, and all of a sudden people found out they were underwater. That meant that they had their house was not worth what they were paying for it, and some people decided, I'm not going to just keep making these huge payments on a house that I'll never be able to sell for the amount of money I have into it. And others just couldn't make because they lost their jobs and because they had these revolving, loans where they had escalated payments, where the mortgage interest went up. All of a sudden, they found that the mortgage they would have to pay was greater than they could afford. Now people say, well, you should have known all this. But, this stuff is all very complicated, and I've certainly bought a home and refinanced it, and it's always complicated. What the simplest thing would be to do, because the government is the receiver of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which owns about 60% of these loans, is just to put in the government to put in the difference and then allow everybody to go back and refinance their homes, bring them down to their level they're at now, the market level, and refinance that. You'd stimulate so much investment. But the government has not decided not to do that. We can't have the votes in Congress to get that passed. So what we've done is this remedy thing that requires the banks to give you a second chance, essentially, to look at it. And I would suggest that if you're interested in that, it requires the banks to do due diligence. They can't just, receive your papers and put them in a drawer and then foreclose on you, which is what they've been doing. They've not been a consumer-friendly process at all. And Congress is requiring them to be that. And so what I'd suggest is if you need specific help on everybody's problem is different. But we have a person in our office who specializes. Her name is Nancy DeSerpa, and she's in my Salinas office. And that number is 424-2229, 424-2229. And our office is open during normal work days. It's in the downtown post office right next to the county courthouse on South Street. So either go in and visit Nancy or call her, and she can head you in the right direction. Thank you for the question.
Okay, our next question comes from Chuck Frank from Carmel Valley. Chuck has a question about tax cuts. Chuck, you are on with Congressman Farr.
Yes, hello. The question I have is if we do not extend the tax cuts for the top 2%, I'm only talking about the top 2%, what additional tax revenues would be generated?
Well, the cost to us, we know the cost of extending those, it's $1 trillion just for the upper 2%. So that would be a savings of $1 trillion. And what it means is that people are getting a tax break of $160,000 if their filed income, that's not their earned income, but their filed income exceeds $1 million. And what will happen with the plan that they passed today is that the average tax increase for about 25 million families that are earning incomes below $250,000, and that's usually for people filing jointly, an income of $250,000, your tax would go up by $1,000 on average. This is average across the country. And $160,000 would be increased $160,000 for the average income and state tax cut for households with incomes over $1 million, and the total of that is in excess of $1 trillion. So that's how much money we'd save if we didn't extend for the rich.
Thank you for that question. Our next question comes from Rick Fetick from North Salinas. Rick has a question about water. Rick, you are on with...
Hi. This is Rick. We spoke.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
Good, good. My health's good. Listen, California as a state has grown wealthy because of federal water projects. We know that in the Salinas Valley we have an independent water system, and I of course we all want to keep it independent, but we also know we have some water problems. We have more water being pumped up from the aquifers in the Salinas Valley. We have saltwater intrusion. We have the Carmel River issue with a tight deadline. I wonder if we can get some federal help, not maybe some money, but even more, some guidance, some arbitration between the competing interests, some help to balance Cal-Am and some other private companies that are holding us over a barrel. It's not a barrel of water they're holding us over. It's a barrel of their money that's going to be shaken out of our pockets. What kind of help can we get?
Well, Rick, obviously you understand the problem, and it is complex. It's a complex problem that we've chosen to at least remain with our own backyard and deal with it in our political fashion through the county Board of Supervisors and through the Monterey Peninsula Water Management District. Yes, we have. We decided many years ago when the state of California was teaming up with the federal government to build a huge water project, the largest in the world, bringing water from Northern California down to Southern California and allowing people along the way in agriculture in the San Joaquin Valley to have water for their crops. I mean, this was a giant project. I think astronauts have said it's the one man-made project you can see from the moon. But it's been a very successful. I mean, there's all kinds of disputes, but the engineering of it is phenomenal. In fact, just a little trivia question: the largest cost of electricity in California is the pumping charges of pumping all that water over the Tehachapis, and you can see that when you go over the Grapevine, you can see the big, huge water project. So here in Monterey County, we decided, no, we're not hooking up with you. We don't want anything to do that. We'll do it on our own. And Monterey County built two dams on the Salinas River, the Nacimiento, and the the other dam we have there, the on the Salinas River, and then that allows water out, and that water flows down the Salinas River, and all the farming communities along the valleys pump their water out. You're right. If you pump it out faster than it goes back in, then you have the water from the ocean intruding because it's up there next to it. So the water between Salinas, the city of Salinas, and the coast is no longer pumped out of the ground. What they're using is reclaimed water from all the sewage treatment that the peninsula and the city of Salinas send over to Marina to this giant reclamation plant. That's a very good thing. All that's good. The Salinas folks say, look, we're paying for this project and for the water, and we don't want you to come over from the Monterey Peninsula and take it from us. And so that's politics. And on the other hand, the Monterey Peninsula has always had their water delivered by a private utility company, now known as Cal-Am. And Cal-Am essentially operates two dams in the Carmel Valley, one which is non-functional, and we're working to come down near the end. This is a long answer to your question, but part of your, that we are showing that there is a private-public partnership where the government is partnering with Cal-Am, is tearing down the San Clemente Dam. That dam has been ruled by the state Bureau of Dam Safety to be unsafe in an earthquake, and you either have to make it safe by just pouring tons of concrete, which would do absolutely nothing but make it a big thick dam, and by the way, there's no water behind it because it's totally filled with silt. So we've come together in an unholy alliance that's working very well and very mutually supportive, saying to Cal-Am, you'd have to pay $50 million to tear that thing down. They can get that money from the ratepayers because they are a public utility, and they get reimbursed on their costs. But they put up the capital. We don't have to go out and, you know, do a public bond for that. What we've suggested is tear it down and fix the river so that it really is a normal running river. And that is going to cost another $21 million in the public and private sector foundation money, federal money, and state coastal conservancy money is doing that. And the green light is there, and I think we're going to get it done. It'll be the first dam in the United States of its size to be pulled down. We can be very proud of it, and we'll be the first community to restore a river. That doesn't answer our water problems, so we're going to have to turn to the ocean and have desalinization. And what the battle is on the peninsula now is exactly, you know, who should operate that, whether it be a public entity or a private entity. How much of that water should come from the ocean? How much of it should come from drilling of wells and taking the, you know, fresh water? And how much could you save if you turned all the football fields and golf courses and public spots by using reclamation water? And there is a pipeline coming back from Marina to the peninsula to deliver that reclaimed water. The Pebble Beach Golf Course is already, and I think maybe the golf course at the mouth of the valley, are running themselves on reclaimed water now, and have been for some time using the treatment at the Carmel treatment facility. So the goal here, and I'll summarize all these complex issues. The big goal here is, one, is to put no pollution in the ocean. Two, to find the best mix, affordable mix of waters that will allow us to have a sustainable development on the Monterey Peninsula, sustainable living, not in sprawl, not growth, but just, you know, with the water we have now, but replacing the Carmel River wells with other water. And the Salinas Valley is working to make sure that the stuff they put on the crops doesn't get back down in nitrates and stuff to get back into the groundwater and pollute the very water they're pumping out of the ground. So these are all, each one of these issues is a politic of its own, and yeah, certainly you're aware of that. There is no magic. I mean, there's nothing the government can do to come in and say, oh, we have a third idea or fourth idea that's better than anything you've thought of. I think all the ideas of all the possibilities that we can do are there on the Monterey Peninsula and in Salinas Valley. We just have to have the leadership to get them done.
Thank you for that question. Remember, if you have a question for Congressman Farr, press *3 on your phone at any point during the call. You'll still be able to hear everything that's going on, and somebody will be with you shortly to take your name, your city, and your question. Our next question comes from Fortney Lundy from Salinas. Fortney has a question about federal employees and the deficit. Fortney, you are on with Congressman Farr.
Hello, Congressman. How are you doing?
Hi, Fortney. Thank you for listening.
I think you know the answer to this question. As you know, in your district, there's several hundred, maybe over 1,000 federal employees and retirees.
4,000, if you count the military, about 4,000.
Okay. And I was wondering if you think that Congress or some members of Congress are going to continue to come after the federal employees to help pay for the deficit.
Well, for need, there are some who don't like government at all and would love to shut it down. They would like to privatize everything. It doesn't make any sense when you think about how do you privatize all the roads, how do you privatize all the schools, how do you privatize all the stuff that the government does. And so what it is, well, let's just cut squeeze. And they're not going to have the votes to do that because it doesn't really make any sense. I mean, if you can do that, why don't you get rid of the local governments, and consolidate all the school boards and have one school board or things like that? I mean, there's all these ideas out there. If you really wanted to think that they were great, you'd start in the local level and show that there's a model that works and let the rest of us move that. No, they want to just go after largesse and say, well, this is a big government, and therefore let's cut it, squeeze it, and trim it. And, you know, the cost of government and the cost of business is usually labor costs, and that's the highest cost. And so you go after the federal employees. And, I don't support that at all. I happen to have a lot of staff who work very hard and, work on limited salaries and so on like that. And their dedication to public service is amazing. And, to go after them, I don't think is the answer. And to go after people who have made careers in government, our State Department, and certainly I believe you were in public service, and you were a very professional person. So I'm very sympathetic and very supportive of the way you're approaching it, which is not just to cut, squeeze, and trim and take the benefits away from federal employees.
Congressman, do you want to do the poll now?
Yeah, this is fun. Thanks for asking. What we've been doing in these town hall meetings is just kind of doing an informal poll. We sort of devised it ourselves. And what we do is I'll read the question to you, and then you just press the appropriate button on the phone to give your answer. And so here's the statement and question. Last year, Congress passed the Budget Control Act, which included an idea called sequestration, which will automatically trigger large cuts to both domestic and military programs if Congress fails to reach an agreement on the long-term deficit, which would have to be reached by the end of this year. The automatic trigger in the law is an incentive to get both parties to work together. We haven't found a solution, and the year is running out. So here's the question. In order to achieve the long-term debt reduction, what do you think Congress ought to do? And I'll give you four options, and you push the number key on your phone for the option that you best like. The first option would be number one on your key, to repeal the tax cuts for the wealthy and eliminate the cross-the-board cuts, the sequestration. Number two on your phone would be to go forward with sequestration. Just let it all go. Number three on your phone would be to raise the taxes on the wealthy combined with some budget cuts. And the fourth number on your phone would be none of the above. So press the number, and I'll read them quickly again, and then we'll give you the results in a minute. The first is repeal the tax cuts on the wealthy and eliminate the sequestration. Number two, go forward with the sequestration. Number three, raise taxes on wealthy combined with budget cuts. Number four, none of the above. I'll be interested in what the poll shows us, and we'll get back to you on that in a minute.
All right. Our next question comes from Annette Tabor from Hollister. Annette has a question about Obamacare.
Hello.
Hello, Annette.
Yes. Oh, before I go any further, I'm a registered Republican, have voted Republican all my life. But in any case, yes, with Obamacare, it's my understanding that although it's passed for the general population, that Congress, the Senate, and the congressmen have private insurance and they will not be covered under that. They have their own private. Is that correct?
No. Right now, we are treated just like federal employees, and federal employees are treated just like state and local employees, only state and local have a different plan. They run under the state of California. And let me quickly explain that, what it is. When you're employed by the government, by local or state, or in this case federal government, you're given as an employee a sort of a directory of insurance plans that are available in your county that the government has gone out and negotiated with insurance, Blue Cross, Aetna, Kaiser, all the ones that you've heard of, and says to these companies, look, we've got a million or so more personnel that could possibly benefit from your plan. Would you give us a group plan at an affordable rate? And then we get that book, and it shows what your copayment is. I think for my plan that covers myself and my wife, Sherry, I pay $483 a month as my copay. The government pays part as my employer, but it is a group plan. And it is the same for me as it is for the people on my staff or for people who are working for the government in the Department of Defense or whatever it is, you know. So it's we're all in the same pool. Under the Obamacare plan is people have thought that we had a special kind of Cadillac deal. So they said, okay, no longer will members of Congress or the senators be able to buy from the federal insurance plan. They're going to have to go out and buy from private insurance. So we don't get the advantages of being in this big group. The advantage of being in a big group is they never ask you pre-existing conditions. You don't have to fill out any history of health care. You're just, you know, when they buy that insurance, they say, we're going to give you a million customers regardless. You can't ask them the questions. You can't give them and say, we're only going to insure you for this, that. The private insurance can do that. Say, you know, under the Obamacare, they can't because there's no pre-existing conditions. But obviously, it's going to drive up the cost of health care for us to be outside of the federal system.
Thank you for that question. Callers, remember, if you have a question for Congressman Farr, please press star 3 at any point. Our next question comes from Esther Cabrera from Salinas. Esther has a question about the Veterans Cemetery at Fort Ord.
Yes, hello, Sam Farr. I have a son who is a former Marine. He was in Iraq. He's 27, and right now he's he's incarcerated. But my question is to you is that if anything should happen to him, will or any of the military that is here in Monterey County, are they going to be opening anything, maybe some kind of cemetery or something over here by Fort Ord? I mean, I would really hate to take him all the way to Sentinella because to go see him all the time over there would, you know, is not an easy thing for me. I want him close by.
Did he leave the military with an honorable discharge?
Yes, he did, sir. He has.
Okay.
He was. He was overall Marine in Camp Ordinal.
Okay. So yes, he's entitled to be buried in a federal military or a state military veteran cemetery. We do have land set aside at Fort Ord. The federal government will not pay for that cemetery because they said, as you said in your question, there's space available at Santa Anella. Now, I'm very much opposed to that policy. I've tried to change it, saying the 70-mile from an open cemetery is just nuts. Well, you build all the cemeteries in San Joaquin Valley, 70 miles, and get you from Nevada in one direction into the ocean in the other. There's no people that live in Santa Anella. It's just nuts to have a big, you know, formal military ceremony on a cemetery out in the middle of nowhere. And they won't change this policy, and I can't get Congress to do it because they've just all wedded to this crazy idea for a long time. But they do have Plan B in the federal law. It says that states can build cemeteries. Well, we run into a wall in California because California says as a state, we're not going to build cemeteries. Other states have. Hawaii's got 11 of them. We're not going to do it. California is committed to and is doing a good job of to doing veterans' homes, of doing rest homes, long-term care homes, nursing homes for veterans. And Yountville is a good example of where they have a nice one. So what's happened is that I've worked with the elected officials in Sacramento, our local electeds, over the last couple of years and saying, what if we come up with Plan C or the third idea where the local governments can raise the money and get and then put that money in an account for the state, and then the state can apply for the federal state program. And in that program, you get 100% reimbursement. So right now, and this is the unfortunate thing, we've got the land set aside. We've got tons of people working on this. We've got the backup government, FORA, is saying we'll be the lead agency. We'll do all the, we'll operate the purse strings and everything for this. And But we've got to come up with $2 million, which is the first stage of the cemetery. And the veterans groups have been trying to raise that money through golf tournaments and dinners and so on. What we really need, if you know anybody that will lend them $2 million, they'll get paid back. It's a sure thing. There's no risk here. We'll lend the money for $2 million. We'll get it started because that's what the state says all they need in order to make their application. So I'm hoping that we can find that $2 million somewhere soon and get the cemetery going.
Thank you for that question. Congressman, do you want to give the results of the poll?
Yeah, I've just been handed the results. Thank you, staff, for doing this. Remember, I gave you four options, and you pushed the number key. And I've been doing this on four or five town hall meetings I've held, and it's interesting. The results are almost exactly the same in every one of them. The first one was to repeal the tax cuts for the wealthy and eliminate the across-the-board cuts. 19% voted yes. The second was to go forward with sequestration, just cut across the board, boom, regardless. 12% voted yes on that. The third, which is that compromise one of raise taxes and cut some budgets, was 52%. And the last one was none of the above, which is 17%. So 17% said just leave it like it is. More than half of you voted to do the combination of cut and raise on the wealthy. 12% on just cut across the board, and 19% on just tax cuts on the wealthy. So I found in every one of my polls that third one, raise taxes on the wealthy combined with some touch, is always polled over 52%. That, frankly, is the common sense approach, and that's the very thing that we didn't do today when we voted on a bill. We didn't do that combined effort, and I think until we get there, we're not going to get the American people to be satisfied with the work of Congress. Thank you very much for your opinion.
Okay, our next question comes from Josh from Salinas. Josh has a question about corporate money in politics. Josh, you're on with the Congressman.
Thank you very much for having this town hall meeting by phone. My question is, with something like three-quarter support among the American people, when can we have a constitutional amendment to say that money isn't speech and that money can be regulated in our politics and that corporations aren't people?
Well, Josh, you're absolutely correct. Because of a Supreme Court decision, it's going to take a constitutional amendment to put the law back in place. Prior to a Supreme Court decision called Citizens United, any money in federal politics had to be, first of all, it banned corporations from giving checks. They could form political action groups known as PACs and put money into that, but they could not just write a check from a corporate, or even, you know, most small businesses are corporations. They couldn't use their small business to give a contribution to anybody. We did allow contributions to be given, but we also put a limit on it. For example, right now the federal limit for any candidate, including the President of the United States, is I think $2,500 per person. And if you want to give a PAC contribution, it's $5,000 per year. And if you and in every case, you have to disclose who you are, who's giving the check. Citizens said, look, if you go out there and form a third entity, not the, you know, pro and con on a candidate, not the Democrat, Republican, or pro and con on a proposition, you don't have to disclose, and you can get your money from anywhere you want. So what's happened, and you're going to see it in this election, and I think it's ruining America, it's really going to ruin democracy, is that anybody can form a third-party campaign for or against a candidate and go out and raise money from all their friends and from corporations, and they don't have to disclose, and all of a sudden they start running ads. You're not going to know, you know, we have to say, if I'm running an ad, I have to say at the end of the ad, this ad was paid for by Sam Farr. But under Citizens, if somebody runs an ad, they don't have to tell you anything. And when you go to say, well, who is that? I'd like to know who paid for that ad. You can't find out because they don't have to disclose. So it's bad for America because we always believe strongly in a democracy that you need full transparency. You need to have it out there that people can look at it, people can make a judgment of of, you know, of their own, and this is sort of secrecy at its worst, and I think it's wrong, and 82% of the Americans in polling show that they don't like that Supreme Court decision. So there is an attempt to have a constitutional amendment and get it passed by all the states necessary to amend our Constitution. It's going to take a number of years, and I hope we're successful with it.
Thank you for that question. Our next question comes from Jean from Salinas. Jean has a question about socialized medicine. Jean, you're on with Congressman Farr.
Thank you. I've seen what socialized medicine is like in Europe. You'll wait 3 and 4 hours to just ask a simple question of a doctor instead of being able to make a phone call. I saw that firsthand with my relatives in Italy. It will not work. It does nothing but cost us, those that are paying for all the others. What you need to do is give all the insurance companies carte blanche across all state lines, make them all take a percentage of the pre-existing conditions, and things will prosper. It'll be a whole lot better than the way it's going to be under Obamacare.
Well, Gene, first of all, the so-called Obamacare is not socialized medicine. It's not socialized when the private insurance control it. The government doesn't control it. Pardon me? Huh? Do you have insurance right now? Well, I guess I've lost you. But
I pay a pretty good penny for it, but I also have contribution from my employer.
Yeah, well, you know what? Under Obamacare, that won't change at all. Hopefully your costs are going to come down because we're going to have everybody insured. But this is not socialized medicine. This is the farthest thing from it. The government doesn't control the insurance policies.
When you're penalizing people that don't want to participate, and you make them pay for it, it's a tax.
You're being penalized right now because the person who doesn't want to pay for it is saying, I don't want to pay for it, I don't get hurt, I don't get injured, and goes out and crashes their motorcycle and because they didn't want to buy insurance, and all of a sudden they're in the hospital, and the hospital is having to give expensive care, and guess who's paying for it? You are. You're paying it for in two ways. You're paying for it in taxes, which help that hospital meet its uncovered insurance, and you're paying for it in your own insurance policy. Because insurance policies are based on reimbursements to hospitals and doctors based on the cost of doing business. So everybody who doesn't have insurance, you and I are paying for it. What's fair about that? Yeah, we say if you don't want to buy insurance, you can have a savings account. That counts. That's fine. If you don't want to buy any insurance whatsoever, when you file your taxes, you're making enough money, we'll take a piece of that, a small amount, which will cover those uncompensated costs. This is not socialized medicine. Farthest thing, when you require the entire system to be run by private sector, they set the rates, just like the private insurance you have now. They set the rates. The government didn't set that. And then the way I explained it earlier to the gentleman who asked about, the person who asked about whether members of the legislature or the Congress were covered under it. With the Blue Cross insurance that I buy is a private insurance. And because it's a group, we say you can't have pre-existing conditions. So what we've said to this is that all the insurance companies have to play by the same rules, have to offer the same policy. They'll decide what those rates are, and hopefully they're going to have them more affordable because they want you to buy their insurance. And as for those who have an insurance policy right now, it won't change. What you'll have is an option to go around and look and see if somebody has a better plan at a cheaper price. And I think that's free market enterprise at its best.
Thank you for that question. Our next question comes from Raymond from Hollister. Raymond has a question about VA healthcare.
Hello?
Yeah, this is Raymond Baez from Austin, California. Hello, Congressman Farr. I was reading the paper that in the Oakland office of the VA, they're having a lot of problems with the backlog of VA claims. When I had cancer about 2 years ago, they outsourced my claim to Arizona because there were two backlogs over here in Oakland. So I was just saying, why can't they outsource to these other states that don't have a lot of backlog like California does? And that way they can move it along a lot faster.
Well, Raymond, there's two things here. One is the veterans' benefits who are applying for disabilities, and you're right. The office in Oakland is just inundated. I'm on the committee, on the appropriations committee that sets out money from that. We've set aside to the secretary saying, get this Oakland backlog fixed. We're giving you the authority and some money to do that. We want it fixed right now. In fact, today I signed on the floor a letter by Jackie Spear from the San Mateo County, who's her veterans are all concerned as well. I said, yeah, I'll sign as many letters as we can to keep this issue in front of everybody that we've got to fix the Oakland backlog. But the second about the access to veterans care, that's a lot of, you know, we have to go to Palo Alto if you want it. So what I've done, and we built a clinic at Fort Ord when the troops left, we picked up one of those buildings and have a state-of-the-art clinic, but it's just, as you stated, it's overcrowded. So many people want to use it. So we're going to expand it, and I've just made a deal with the Department of Defense and the Department of Veterans Affairs to build the first joint clinic. I mean, they should have been doing this long ago, because you can't be a veteran without having been in the Department of Defense. They have your original papers. Most likely your injury was always caused there. That's why we're paying those benefits, and they ought to be working together. So the first clinic in the United States that's going to be joint is going to be built at Fort Ord, and it'll be state-of-the-art. It'll be privately built and leased back to the Veterans Department and the Department of Defense for a joint clinic. You walk in that door, it doesn't matter whether you're a spouse of a military or a child of a military or a veteran, you're going to get quality care, and it'll be seamless. And I'm very excited about this, because we're going to find it both accessible and affordable.
Okay. Unfortunately, callers, we are out of time. But if you have a question that the congressman didn't get a chance to get to, stay on the line and leave him a voicemail. We'll get all the voicemails tomorrow, and we'll get back to you. Congressman, do you have any closing thoughts?
Well, I just want to tell everybody thank you for listening. I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody's question, but I'm leaving here tomorrow at 6 a.m., and I'm going to be home for a whole month, 30 days, in the county and around Monterey Bay. I'm having those town hall meetings in Hollister, Monterey, Salinas, and Santa Cruz. Again, check my website for the dates and times. And then I'll be starting the first one in about a week or so. So I want to see you in person, and I thank you for listening. And please, if you want to still leave a question, leave it on the voicemail, and we'll get back to you as soon as possible. Thank you, and have a good weekend. Bye-bye.
Callers, just to clarify, if you need us to get back to you, make sure you leave your name and your contact information. That way we can actually get back to you. Thank you very much. Have a good night.